first couple of verses tell us in chapter 9 that there were a group of Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, so on and so forth, living together, and they hear something, don't they? They hear something together. They were living in the lowlands, and they heard there, just before the end of verse 1, they heard of this, it says. They heard of this. Here's these groups of people, and they have heard something. And what we see in verse 2 is that because of what they heard, they did what they did. So they're responding to what they heard, aren't they? And what they decided to do was to gather together and fight against Joshua and Israel. So whatever it was that they heard, or whatever they understood from what they heard, hardened their hearts and pushed them into an even more aggressive stance towards Joshua and Israel than they might have had before. It set them on the path of war, didn't it? They became very angry and decided to destroy Israel because of what they heard. Now, we're not told specifically what it was that they'd heard. And you only have to look back over the previous couple of chapters and see that Joshua and the Israelites had made a covenant on Mount Ebal. That was obviously very, very significant, very public, blessings and cursings. You look back at the beginning of chapter 8 to see that they destroyed the city of Ai. Thank you. They'd also destroyed the city of Jericho, hadn't they? They'd crossed the river Jordan, miraculously so. So there's lots of different things that they could well have heard. And whatever it was that they heard made them more determined to destroy Israel. Whatever it was they heard made them determined to get together to seek to destroy Israel. Now, perhaps you're thinking, well, if I'd heard that God had opened the river and destroyed two cities and they'd enacted a covenant with God on the mountains, that might make you more inclined to kind of want to make peace with the people like that. But no, whatever it is they heard, it set them on the war path. And I think if you go back to chapter 7 and verse 9 and to hear Joshua praying after the defeat of Israel by the little town of Ai, when you look at chapter 7 and verse 9, I think we get down to what it is that these people heard that emboldened them to make war. In chapter 7 and verse 9, we hear Joshua praying. And as he prays, he is very, very distressed. The Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will surround us and cut off your name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? What he's concerned about is that the people will hear that the little city of Ai has defeated them in battle. And if all these other nations hear that they can be beaten by a little town like that, then surely they're going to get bold and come out and declare war and think they can take us out. So I'm putting it to you that what these other tribes have heard is that the little city of Ai has beaten Israel. That's the thing that they've heard. And because they've heard that, they make this decision that they're going to make war. It's like an earthquake often happens, and sometime later you get a tsunami, don't you? There's something happens, and then it's over, and then later something else happens as a result of it. It's like the sin that led to Israel's defeat in Ai has happened, and then only later they then came back, didn't they? And they defeated Ai, but the news of the defeat of Ai seemingly has not arrived to these far-off tribes, only their defeat. So they're getting a distorted picture. They've only got part of the story. And because they've only got part of the story, they're making a very ill-informed decision. And there are people out there who only understand Christianity so much. And because they only understand so much of Christianity, they set their minds against Christianity and they are hostile to it, even very aggressive to it. And we see something like that here. And the truth is that there was sin in Israel's camp. Something did happen in Israel something really bad happened in Israel. And because of that, these enemies are made bold. Why did they get defeated? Because of Israel's sin. Why do people say bad things, at least in part, against the Christian church? Have the Christian church ever done bad things? Have they ever failed? Are there any flaws? Is there any sin ever in the history of God's people? Well, in the same way, our weaknesses, our sinful weaknesses, embolden our enemies. They embolden those who are hostile to the gospel, especially if that is the information that's been presented to them. They love, don't you hear that on the news sometimes, or on the media? You get a certain snapshot, they zoom in on some weakness, some shortcoming, some failing, and they present it and they play it out large, and you think that's Christianity. You think that's what Christianity is like. And of course, that emboldens those who are hostile. But in the passage that we're looking at, that is not the only point of view that is being expressed. So some people are getting more aggressive because of what they hear. But as we move down from in verse 3, we see the inhabitants of Gibeon hear, and we're told specifically what they hear. They heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai. They hear about the victories. They're hearing something different. They have more specific information. And the truth is that Gibeon, it's described as one place, but in verse 17 we're told it's in fact four cities. It's a very strategic block, really right near where they are, where Israel is positioned. So these are the people who are closest to Israel, and they have more up-to-date and better information about Israel. Whereas the people who are farther away have less relevant information and they're more hostile. The people who are close decide, as we see here, on the basis of what they know to try and make peace with Israel. So can you see what we've got here? We've got two groups of Canaanites, and they're both making their minds up about their relationship to the people of God. And they're both coming to different conclusions, but that's partly because they're basing their decisions on different information. The more information they have, the better the information they have, the more open they seem to be, the less information they have, the more the weaknesses and shortcomings of Israel are painted large, the more hostile they seem to be. So I think there's something there about getting information out and getting information out accurately and clearly. But one thing is very, very clear. Not everybody responds to the church, as it were, in the same way. You've got two different responses. One lot are for war. The other lot are broadly for peace, aren't they? Some people actually want to have a good relationship with these people. Other people want nothing to do with them whatsoever. Well, I think we get this as we go down into verse 6, as they come along to try and make their peace initiative, the people of Gibeon come to their make a peace. Now, they are the minority. There's a small number of people who are coming to try and find peace, where the majority of people are hostile. But we have to see that the people who want peace know more about the people of God than the people who want war. That seems to be the portrait that is being painted here. So let's be clear that our stand for the gospel, our stand for Jesus Christ, divides people's opinions. There are divided opinions. You can't just assume that everybody thinks the same way. Some people actually know quite a lot about the good that goes on amongst God's people. They hear bits of news, they see things, and they understand things. And as a consequence, they're very open, they're quite God-fearing and quite susceptible to Christianity, if I can put it like that. And there's a lot of people out there who are very hostile to it. And when you pick underneath the surface, when you talk to them underneath the surface, oftentimes they really don't understand Christianity at all. They think it's one thing, and they've completely misread it. And consequently, they have these very strong and misguided opinions. So here we've got a presentation, what seems to be a very simple presentation in Joshua chapter 9, that there are these two groups of people. Some of them are your friends, some people are your enemies, and the world is divided into those who are for you and those who are against you. But when we get to verse 14, we're brought up pretty sharp, aren't we? And so we read about how they brought these provisions, and they put this very cunning plan together to try and make this broker this peace agreement with Israel. And verse 14 says, so the men took some of their provisions. They're examining the Gibeonite bread. Do you remember the bread that they said was old, but in fact it was new? They examined it, but there's one important thing missing. What are they not doing? They are not praying, are they? They're not praying about what is going on in this situation. So this kind of ties back to something we were talking about this morning. You know, we have our senses and we have our eyes in our heads. We've got our ears. We can make decisions. We observe things. We're making decisions all the time. But if you do that without prayer, if you don't allow God to speak into our lives and speak into our situations, we are exposing ourselves, as these people expose themselves, to making big, big mistakes. So let's just stop back and just think about that for a moment. They didn't seek the Lord. And what happened was a consequence of their failure to pray. Just in the same way as what happened at the Battle of Ai was actually down to their failure to pray. It was their problem. It was their fault. These things happened, and it was their responsibility. The opportunities were there for them. They didn't take full advantage of what was there. Is there a time ever going to be when we won't need God? Is there going to be a time where then actually we can continue on in our Christian life without his particular help and aid? We'll never have that time, will we? Over the course of your life, we're looking at this in Colossians, of your Christian life, there are certain things that God will give you, and he will change you, and he will shape you and add things to you. So, for example, we read in Colossians how they came to understand the grace of God. And people do, don't they? They come to understand the grace of God. It's a wonderful thing. That happens. That's a gift from God, isn't it? And he imparts that understanding to you. He understands it perfectly. And we can understand that grace too. And then we also read in Colossians as well, chapter 1, verse 19, about how he prayed that they grow in spiritual wisdom and understanding. It is possible that we can get wiser and more understanding than we presently are. There's room for improvement. And with prayer and by God's grace, we can grow in wisdom and we can grow in understanding. But there's more to it than that. We talk about in Colossians chapter 1, verse 10, we can come to live worthy of the Lord. So there are things that we do. So oftentimes when we come to Christ, we come as a Christian, there are things that we do that are just really not acceptable to the Lord. And we have to learn, don't we? We have to grow. We have to change. We can get transformed. We get gradually transformed. Sometimes we only realize it years into our Christian life that there's something that we do or an attitude that we hold that really is very unpleasing to the Lord. But we're able to, by God's grace, change and become more godly. Let's use that word, godly. Colossians chapter 1 verse 11 talks about being strengthened and being given the ability to endure patiently. That we were talking about patience, Maris and patience. That's something that we can get given from God, that strength, that determination. And there's also a joy, a thankful joy. Those things are things that God will form and shape in you. They're aspects of his own character and nature, wisdom and understanding and knowledge and strength. He'll give you those things. In short, over your life, we should expect to become more godly. And that word godly we looked at when we were doing Ephesians, it's being like God. Now, we have to be very careful. You know, some people, they think they're God, right? And there's nothing more arrogant and annoying and frustrating than somebody who thinks they're God. And that's because they fail to understand the difference between those things that God will give to you and those things that God won't give to you. If he makes you more patient and more enduring and more gracious and more wise and more understanding, everybody will rejoice. People love to be around people who are like that. And that's the gift of God. But anybody who thinks they're all powerful and all knowing just gets up everybody's nose. Because the truth is, we'll never be all knowing and we'll never be all powerful. In fact, always, I'd say this is a truth, there's always going to be more that you don't know than what you do. There'll always be more that you can't do than you can. And I think we have to accept our limitations. There's always more that we can't do than we can. There's always more that we don't know than we do. But God is all-powerful and knows all things. We will always need his eyes, his knowledge, his understanding, his insight onto our situation. And in this particular case, they did not inquire of the Lord. There was so much they didn't know. There was so much they didn't understand. And all they had to do was ask. And they didn't ask. Why do we not ask? What happens? We actually think we've got it. I'm okay here. I can do this without you. It's really, really arrogant, isn't it? However wise you are, however knowledgeable you are, however understanding you are, however full of grace you are, you will never be so wise, so knowledgeable, so understanding, so full of grace that you won't need God. In fact, conversely, the more gracious, wise, understanding you are, the more you'll realize you need God. And yet you can see, in fact, that there's a kind of spiritual immaturity. They have such a big responsibility before them. All they had to do was pray. All they had to do was ask. And did they? No. It's all right, God. I can do it. Stand back. Ben's on the job. Disaster, isn't it? It's disastrous. We'll never arrive at a time in our life when we don't need to pray. Ever. We'll always need to pray. And that's, as I said, what happened when they went into the Battle of Ai. You thought they'd have learnt. They didn't ask for God's plan. They didn't ask for God's leading. They were routed. Now, sometimes, and this is the really frustrating, sometimes we make decisions in our own strength and it goes well. But let me tell you, it's a potluck. If you get guidance from God, it will prosper. It will prosper. They didn't need to pray because they thought they didn't have to, clearly. It's arrogance, isn't it? And the Gibeonites came along and they thought, I understand this situation. I know what to do. I've got this. And it just made me think about when Jesus was walking down the road with the disciples and he was talking to them after he'd been raised from the dead. And what did they say? We thought that this Jesus would. Do you remember how he was talking like that? They just completely, all they had to do was listen and ask, and they would have understood. Pride comes before a fall every single time. They didn't pray, and then you can see that the grumbling and the complaining and the stresses and the strains that end up in their midst as a result. So if we said the first thing, that we have a faith that divides people's opinions and divides people, then what we're saying here, that the fact that we are imperfect in our faith, and especially when we're prayerless in our faith, or we're not walking right with God in our faith, that contributes to the mixed opinions and the mixed experiences that other people have of our faith. And that's a very serious thing to think about, isn't it? Because in one sense, we have a wonderful security. But there are other people who don't enjoy that same security. And in one sense, though we might make mistakes because we didn't pray, other people are left with an impression of us that may put them off in such a way, and they may not have the same security that we enjoy. That's all I'm trying to say, is that our prayerfulness is not just for our benefit. They could have been so much clearer with the Gibeonites, for example, if they'd prayed. They'd have been clearer when they went into the Battle of Ai if they'd prayed. And the negative consequences of their prayerless lives were being felt by them and the people all around them. We need to pray. So lastly, it wasn't just the Gibeonites and the Canaanites who are being the Gibeonites and the Canaanites were also being affected, which is the point I'm trying to make. The Gibeonites are getting the impression that Israel can be defeated. But we know from the word of God that God said that he would send his angel before them and he would drive out the people from the land. These people are all marked out for destruction. There is absolutely no hope for them. Their position is untenable. God will triumph. And yet they've come to believe that that isn't the case because God's people didn't pray. And the Gibeonites, they have got this mixed impression of the people of God. On the one hand, they're victorious, and on the other hand, they're defeated. One day they're successful, the next day they're defeated. If these people don't fear the Lord so much that they always pray, why should they fear the Lord that much? If God's people don't need to pray, then we can approach God in a somewhat disrespectful and arrogant manner ourselves. And so they set this plan in motion to trick and deceive God and his people into entering into a covenant with them. It's a very clever plan, isn't it? You have to admit, don't you? You have to admit, it was a very clever and brilliantly executed plan. But it's produced entirely from the flesh. And the flesh is capable of doing wonderful things from almost like a demonic wisdom. It's brilliant in its conception, isn't it? But in the end, it doesn't get them what they really, really need. They base their plan on the fact that as soon as they get God's people to commit their word and give their word to the situation, they will be home and dry. We see that in verse 19. And the truth is that the people of Israel were honorable, weren't they? Can I just say, as an aside here, these people were very honorable. Did you pick up on that as we read that? That even though they'd said something, even though they knew it was compromising and difficult, they saw it through. Do you always keep your word? If you say something, if you're asked to do something and you agree to do it, do you always do it? Do you see things through? Are you good for your word if you undertake to do something? I remember in the beginning part of my Christian life how I didn't really understand about this. I'd be full of good intentions, but they didn't always materialize. It's really, really important godly quality to do what you said you're going to do, come what may. It's there in the Proverbs, isn't it? Just to see it through, to be faithful to your own word. And because people like this promised to do something they really should never have promised to do in the first place because they didn't pray in the first place, it doesn't excuse us, does it? And that's something very clear from the Bible. So it's better, isn't it, honestly, not to give our word until we're clear that that God wants us to do something and wants us to make these commitments. That, I think, is just wisdom, isn't it? To seek the Lord before we give an undertaking in things as best as we're able. Sometimes it's worth just saying a little something like, God willing, I will. Or I'd love to, I'll do my best. Or I'll try, rather than saying, you can rely on me or something like that. If you're just not sure you're going to be able to do something, it's better, isn't it? Because the world expects God's people to be a faithful people, and so they should. And we should be a faithful people, a people whose word is good. Because in the end, the whole of our offer to the world is based solely in the word, on the set of promises. We're asking people to put the trust of their entire soul into eternity based on something that's said. And therefore, the integrity of our words must be absolute paramount, as best as we're able to be a people of our word. I say that by the by. And they knew that God's people were clearly a people of the word because they trusted the whole plan based around just getting God's people to say something. And once it was said, then they were in. But it's still a tragic story as I read it, because in the end, the Gibeonites, they don't end up anything better than slaves. They end up as servants. Yes, they're alive, but they're just servants and slaves, woodcutters and water carriers. And that's because, as we read in verse 24, they thought they knew everything there was to know about God. They answered Joshua, because it was told to your servants for a certainty that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. So we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing. When you read that, it sounds so plausible. That sort of thing that the Lord said, rather like Eve, when she said, the Lord has told us that we cannot even touch the fruit. Do you remember that? But God actually, as far as we know, never said that. And it's so easy to give, you think you know something, but actually you need to check it out and make sure that you've got it right. These people were entrusting their whole view of their future and the futures of their families based on what they'd heard. Who'd they heard it from? Where did they get their information from? Where does the world get its information from in the main about God? They basically get it from the world, don't they? Have you ever heard, how often can you say you've heard a faithful presentation of the gospel in the media? How often have you heard a faithful, true presentation of the gospel in the public domain, coming from anything other than a kind of a clip or a snapshot of faithful gospel people speaking out from the church? Have you heard many opportunities? Right? So people form their opinions. They hear things, don't they? And they may have a close approximation. They may be near. They may be close to it. But in the end, the tragedy of these things is not only was the people of God not praying, but where do we read about the people of Gibeon? If they wanted a peace with God, why didn't they turn to God? Why didn't they get it from God himself? Why didn't they pray? People are basing their whole salvation on hearsay. Have you met people who think they're a Christian, believe they're part of the church, and you examine them and you talk to them about what they believe, and it's an approximation of Christianity. It isn't the real thing. Have you met that? Have you encountered that? And as a consequence, they don't know the liberty of the children of God. They haven't got the peace. They don't know God as their father. They don't know the joy of their salvation. They have no assurance. Why? Because they've based it all on hearsay. And you say, well, surely isn't that what God said? Weren't these people all marked out for destruction? Tell Rahab that nobody gets saved. Tell Rahab and her family that you can't walk out of the fallen and broken world and its burning ruins. And she ended up marrying one of Judah's leading soldiers. Her descendants went on. The Messiah came from her own descendants. There is hope, always hope. And the people of Gibeon had not understood our God. Surely somewhere there was a covenant that these people could have entered into. You know, what is the covenant we've all entered into? We've entered into a covenant by which we have our old life has been crucified. We are dead, and we have been raised by the power of the Spirit unto a new life through the person of Jesus Christ. You can't tell me that these people could not have entered into such a covenant and given up their old lives and received a new life in Christ. And then lived amongst the people of Israel, not as their servants with God as their Baal, but as their brothers, as Rahab did, with God as their father and Lord. Salvation, grace is all, because our God, I know our God, and our God is a merciful God, a gracious God. And there's so much hearsay. They didn't pray. And the people of God didn't pray. And the little knowledge is a dangerous thing. It's a dangerous thing. So I'm going to close. The hymn comes to mind, obviously. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry some things, everything to God in prayer.